welcome to the next podcast from the Three Academicos. And today is a slightly different format because we have a guest with us. And today the guest is soon to be Dr. Jordan Millward, basically. So, Jordy, do you want to tell us a little bit about what you're doing at the moment and maybe a little bit about your kind of research and whatever? So.
Yeah, of course. So a little bit about me. So as you say, I'm a PhD student, but my vibe is set for the 4th of July. So by the time this probably ends, that will have passed. And as you say, it'll be potentially Dr. Jordan by then. My research area is primarily in more education than sociology, but through the life sciences. And as a result, it's specifically looking at how biological science students go through their academic journey, how they deal with various interactions, and how that experience that they go through really shapes their experience in academia and either enhances it or potentially puts barriers to it. So it's about that bridging interaction that they have at Imperial College London.
Yes. Okay. That's cool. Thank you. And Kepi, have you got any kind of questions about that or any follow-up questions?
Yeah, well, I'm just curious to know what led you to this point in terms of your educational background and just reason why you did decide to do a PhD.
Yeah, sure. So PhD was something I always really wanted to do generally anyway, but it was finding a topic that really, broadly speaking, appealed and was what I felt was where I wanted to go. When I was teaching land-based science students at various different further education colleges, I tended to find that term after term, year after year with each of the students, you'd have a lot of similar barriers that were presenting in them anecdotally. So a lot of that was along the lines of you would have some students being interested in the subject or assuming they were interested in it, but then as they discovered more about what it actually entails, they were like, well, this isn't what I thought it was. This is what I wanted to do, and this is what I want to know, and these are the type of barriers that you would see. And in some cases, that would be they'd have parents and family who had never effectively pursued that area of academia or academia in general, so they didn't really know what it entailed. When you added university into the mix, then some of them were really not sure whether university's understanding of what the opportunities could be is what really prompted me to look at the broader academic spectrum, really, and have a bit more of an understanding of what different students from different backgrounds broadly experience as they go through.
Okay, that's great. Thanks very much for that, Jordan. And so for me, the a question would be, what are your kind of next steps from this point? So, you know, like you say, by the time this podcast goes out, you're probably already going to have your PhD, and you know, it's kind of like, where do you go from there?
I think I can say speak for most PhD students when I say that's probably the million-dollar question, where the daunting dive into academia or going into industry for many, myself included, is generally going through. I've got stuff that I'd certainly say I'd like to do, and hopefully stuff that is coming in the pipeline. But as it stands, I'm certainly looking at staying in more formal academia, postdocs and fellowships, early lecturing roles at different places. Don't get me wrong, it's more easier to probably say a fairer answer about the areas I'd probably be looking at rather than which is ideally looking at experiential learning, and that because it's something that emerged from my PhD that a lot of students, when they're interacting with courses or information, even if they know what they've gone through, so if you tell them this is, let's say, using an agricultural example, this is behavioral ecology, the skill is, they won't necessarily recognize that skill because they won't see the context. But whereas if they do that from an experiential point, they recognize how they've used it, embedded it, and built on it. And I think that's an area that I'd like to explore at some point. And in the interim, if there are other postdocs and academic postings that I'd be quite interested in pursuing, and hopefully something comes up of that regard. And other than that, I have a few ongoing projects that will keep me busy.
Okay, that's cool. Good. Thank you very much. I mean, one of our kind of main interests for Inkepi and for Catherine is kind of distance learning. So what's your what do you think of distance learning and kind of, you know, what's your experience of it basically? So, I mean, have you ever done any distance learning as a learner? Have you delivered any distance learning? So what's your general feeling about distance learning?
So I would say distance learning done well is a really effective tool for flexible learning and asynchronous learning. However, in a lot of cases, distance learning can be done, I would say, in some academic circles as more of a half-baked synchronous style learning, which doesn't really work when it's pitched for some people for flexibility. I know from my own master's degree, there was positives about it, and there was definitely negatives about it. But I've also had the experience of teaching distance learning. I will say the type of distance learning I did was more forced teaching because of COVID. But the main thing with this with that was during the COVID experience, a lot of students would do the typical have their cameras off, not really necessarily engage with the content, and in theory, not even engage with it at all, never mind whether they're interacting with you as a lecturer at that point. But one thing I'm quite interested in looking at within distance learning personally is this falls into this experiential learning more. Experiential learning model where I'm curious of trying to see if you can package contextualized learning experience in different models of teaching. So whether that be hybrid, online, or fully in person, and what the differences between those are, because one of the key points that I think is an opportunity in all of those areas is really pitching the students, look, this is why you're doing it, this is the reason behind it, this is what the research looks at, and then that can hopefully fulfill some of that knowledge gap that we typically see with students. But yeah, the only other thing I'd say on the distance learning point is a bit more about my experience as a student. That was largely when a lot of these experiences you were having. It was put onto a Moodle portal. These were the lecture notes. It was basically a handout that you were reading, and then assignments that you were doing. They had a forum that I would say wasn't really utilized to the best of it. And typically, they would have a recorded lecture. By the time those live lectures would ever happen is in the middle of the working day, because I would presume the member of staff happened to be present on site. But as a result, then most people never were experienced in the session live because they were coming from here, there, and everywhere. And sometimes, or they were working full time themselves, as was my case.
Okay, that's cool. Thanks. Catherine, have you got any questions about kind of what distance learning or anything else really, basically? So,
Yeah, so hi, Jordan. I noticed there you mentioned about how people didn't have their webcams on during the distance learning sessions. So I'm just wondering, did you have experience of sessions with people with cameras on that you noticed that they weren't on? And regardless of that, what are your feelings around the importance of the webcams being turned on?
So in terms of that specifically, I know from I've certainly taught sessions to college students where virtually every webcam was off, and as a result, it's more the disconcerting feeling of even though now being quite used to talking to my own face on a camera, that reflection of yourself being the only person you can focus on talking back to you makes you recognize any small mannerisms and gestures that you're doing to potentially cause you to lose a bit of flow. And equally, in some cases, when you're it's not just on the webcams side, but when you're looking for that response from a student and you put an open-ended question out there, you can't necessarily see, okay, I can tell let's call them Joey was interested in this because I could see by their face. So I'll ask Joey the open-ended question, or I can see that Katie is struggling, so I'll ask her a question in a more supportive way because you don't get that feedback with the webcam being off. And the other problem I would say with that is then students tended to rely more on the chat, which if you're delivering the session as it stands, you really struggle to monitor the chat and deliver your session in whatever way because you just can't keep track of the two things moving in parallel.
Because I have looked into this in research, and if we think about distance learning as being something that makes learning accessible for people that wouldn't otherwise be able to make use of it, then you can sort of accept the webcam being off more because, like, maybe these are people that are sitting in their kitchen with people around them, or maybe they're even people preparing dinner for for their family as well. So it is an interesting one. I personally, like, I always use my webcam and I do like it when it's on, but I can also be tolerant of, people that choose not to use their webcams as well. Because especially the thing about, special needs as well. You get a lot of special needs who do distance education for that reason, and they're just not comfortable. So for me, as long as they're there, whether or not I can see them, I'm happy. I don't mind if the webcam's off.
I think sometimes though it depends on the how, like with everything, the tools are utilized and the expectations. I know when I was delivering more distance learning modules at the time, it was that rapid onset from COVID, and the problem is the expectation was to have very high, what was largely practically taught sessions into swapping them onto an online format and making sure that delivering skills. If it was more like, let's say, university lecture style or seminar style, you wouldn't generally, I personally wouldn't find the webcam as much of an issue. And particularly if more the rules and expectations are that you'll use the chat will be chat, these will be the times when it can. And equally, technology like Zoom and Teams have moved on leaps and bounds since when COVID started. But at the time, yeah, it just made it, I suppose, quite challenging to, from a teaching experience, to really see track student progress, because what was often also typically the challenges you would have to feed back to management, which is often the problem of how you can basically get them to engage or to see if they've engaged. And that can be the challenge when you've gotten very little feedback from some students.
I suppose it is contextual, really. And one other comment or question I had for you was, I noticed you mentioned about the lack of participation in forums. So I'm just wondering, when you were operating as a student on distance learning, did you participate in the forum, even though you saw that others weren't?
I did somewhat, and I will say there was two types of response. I definitely, myself included, would definitely have done the whole, if you had a question on the assignments and the assessments, the forums would have been more active. What I tended to find was more of a useful time is if the forums were put up at the same time as the assignments, then people engaged far more actively in them and were having more discussions around the work and what they were doing from it, because they have more the context again of how you could frame, okay, this is where it's going to be applied. Whereas if the forum was set up immediately after the lecture and seminar, most people wouldn't necessarily engage with it, because the main reason for that, I could surmise, is that everyone was watching the seminars or doing the reading at different paces, and therefore they didn't necessarily have a question unless they had a question or an understanding point that they really didn't get. But it was more if the assignment came up at the same or similar time, then that would be when both myself and other people would fall before more active on the forums. And that's not just about the little, I would say, the cliches or due dates, that type of thing, the more deeper probing questions and open discussions.
Yeah. Okay, that's fine. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Catherine. One of the things, I wouldn't say challenges for us, but one of the things that we find is that in the industry where we focus, which is kind of computing and kind of cybersecurity, but obviously education is important as well. But where we focus, there tends to be this kind of the split between academic qualifications, industry standard qualifications. Do you find the same thing in your industry, or aren't there really kind of industry qualifications in the areas you work?
I'd be the first one to say there are having worked in education, there are some qualifications that stand out to me as being largely redundant because they're more of a formalization of your experience. You've had to do X amount of years to basically show proof that you've got that competence, and that qualification is basically the proof of your experience. Whereas it the I would say it's the value that the qualification ads. So in education, typical ones are QTLS, PGCE. They are industry related qualifications, but a lot of them are PGCEs. In my view, they teach learning theory, and a lot of the models haven't necessarily evolved massively. You present a portfolio, you record what you've done in your progress, but the problem is they don't actually teach you anything, in my view, about teaching, so to speak, and a lot of the challenge with that is you have to do it because you need the to show competency. But that's the only reason most people are doing it, because it doesn't otherwise have much benefit to you in terms of your professional practice and so on. And I think that's the same with a lot of other qualifications like careers advice, assessors qualifications. Some qualifications like that are definitely more what I would class as more box ticking qualifications, whereas you have more on your other side of that. I would say the core ones are your degrees, your academic achievements, and equally, if you do any form of, let's say, you're doing a formalized view of like how to do training and coaching, or which typically I would say are more pitched as CPD courses, but they can sometimes be far more valuable. I know I did a coding course, which was far more useful than what my than what some of the teaching qualifications were.
Okay, that's cool. And Cappy, have you got any follow-up thoughts on this one?
Well, that was quite interesting, actually, what you said about the fact that you got more from an industry standard course than you did from your academic qualification. And I think that's something that needs to be highlighted a bit more, the fact that with industry, I guess it was more the practical aspect of it, wasn't it, really, rather than that theoretical framework that you would probably get from academia. That was that the difference that you saw then in how you approached both of them, or what you got from both of them?
I suppose a bit of a mix. So the coding one, I needed coding at the time because having done my bachelor's degree and master's degree, I didn't really need coding, or at that point didn't really have a lot of coding embedded in what I was doing. But one of the things with that, just one sec. So yeah, one of the challenges was when you have the coding and that transition to needing to have that practical element that it was embedding, it had a utility to it. The thing that I would say, I suppose, why I'm more negative of the teaching and the careers advice type qualifications are when you one, you're typically doing the role that requires you to do the skill that the qualification is for before you get to it, and therefore really, you are having to learn on the job, so your context is coming from the job, not from the course or the achievements that you're doing in that way. And I would also find that, particularly, I would say this is the devil in the detail of teaching qualifications. If I'm teaching a course, I'm doing all these various different pedagogic techniques and different forms of practice, experiential learning, project-based learning, those types of things, which the PGCE. It does not discuss how to do. It does not deliver that form of teaching. Masters of Educations do, but PGCEs typically teach you how students learn and so on, and you're often taught in an environment where it's Sage on the stage, person stands in front of a PowerPoint, reads the pa a PowerPoint out, which would be, if you were doing a teaching observation, would generally be a straight fail, that observation. And that, I would suppose, it was a bit of a logical fallacy for me from an observational point of view, that they're teaching you to do something that is completely opposite, in an opposite way to what they're what the industry standards is telling you should be learning.
Yeah, no, I totally get that. Thank you.
So just a couple of kind of very general kind of questions for the end, really. So the first one, just a little small thing that, nothing important really. What do you think is the future of education?
So I think the more it's, I'll caveat this with, I think personally education need has needed a bit of a shake up since they had since the advent of the internet, and I think we can all see that generally speaking, students are always lagging behind education from an education sense, because their skills are never, not necessarily at the industry level, but they aren't being taught what is the new information that is highly relevant to them. And the other thing I think is assessment and feedback, it will change dramatically. I've heard two different camps on this. I would definitely not be in one of these, because one is we return to closed book pen and paper based assessments, which one I don't think is very accessible anyway, but that's to try to get around this whole AI, with the advent of large language models and AI. And equally, I think part of that is a lot of our assessments are designed for what would have been practical 60, 70 years ago, when you were doing very, you needed that recall of information, you were doing that skill-based recall, whereas now I think it's more about context, understanding, and going deeper into what those types of areas, why you're doing it, your motivation, the justifications, the critical analysis. And I'm seeing this in students where some of those skills are lagging, and I don't think that is solely to blame with AI and various different tools. I personally think that a lot of that has come down to the fact that we're not effectively doing as strong a job as we could do. Certainly some people are, but not everyone, about what is the purpose of why they're doing various different topics. And I think from an assessment point of view, if we continue to focus on recall of knowledge, it, one, it doesn't really benefit the students who don't perform well in tests, but it also doesn't, in my view, get the best out of the students in terms of their key competencies or their contextualization. And I think that is the shame in education. If we go more that way and change our models, then I think that will enhance the student experience and enhance the industry and productivity generally. However, if we continue to try to hold on to more recall-based assessments in that type of area, I think students are progressively going to lag behind where they need to be, whether that's at academic level or whether that's the industry level, and that will be the barrier. To give you an example, I suppose if I'm giving students an essay on, let's say, of mice and men in English, and all of the students are doing it broadly speaking, even though that would arguably be viewed as largely contextual, from the assumption anyway, most students would approach that and think, what is the author trying to view? What does this speak of the time? But that's rather than being taught how does it make them feel and bring in more of their personal value views and perspectives in, they're taught to basically regurgitate what OCR or edXL are looking for. And it's still very recall based, even though it seems like it's packaged in a different way. And in my view, AI can tell you what the author thinks, but it can't necessarily, or what the author's trying to present, but it can't tell you how your interpretation of that is and how that makes you think about your place in broader society and so on. I mean, that's using more of the humanities as an example, but that would be where I think assessments could go, by showing more understanding, their critical analysis, and more holistic education with AI, not without it.
Okay, that's cool. Thanks for that. Catherine, any follow-up from you, or are you happy?
No, that's fine.
It's okay, cool. And Kirpy, anything from your side?
No, but I'll just move on to that last question. That's
Okay.
a roundup. So, what would your advice be to your 16-year-old self if you could send that message across?
And I think what we're saying there is your advice from I guess from an educational and a kind of career. So in other words, would you still go the same route as you did, or would you
Yeah.
advise it to so that's the
Something
idea.
different. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, my advice would be think about how your story is presented, because how you the different experiences that you do pa package your holistic self. If you focus on as many opportunities as you can get, how do those opportunities link together? What is the value in them collectively as well as individually? And what is the narrative you're trying to present of your professional brand as an individual? And take as many opportunities as you can to build that portfolio.
Okay, that's cool. And Kepi, are you happy with any follow-up from your side?
Nothing for me,
All right, okay,
thanks.
cool. So just like to say thank you to Jordan for some very insightful kind of answers, and for obviously taking the time to be with us. It's always good to have an alternative view, and especially a view from somebody who's more recently a student than maybe other people on the call. So thank you very much for your time, Jordan. And I don't know if you've got any kind of final points or anything you want to make before we kind of close this down?
So I suppose one thing that would be interesting from my perspective and from most people who are in education's perspective to get each of your takes on is what do you all view is the future of, I'll pick up on the more teacher training. What do you think future teachers need? Most of the time we focus on future student need, but what do you believe is a future teacher's need in 5, 10, 15 years' time?
Catherine, do you have any views? What do you?
Well, I think definitely, I think we need more training for people who are moving into distance education, because people who are teaching in academia, at this level generally don't always have a teaching qualification, which is not great. But there's more push to have like fellowship of the Higher Education Academy. And that would be more generally expected now. Although, I'm not that old, but when I started teaching, there was no requirement for that. And then the distance education introduces another dimension to that. And there's really not much training out there for distance learner tutors. And it's something that we even need to think about, and maybe an opportunity that we could contribute to, because. Are there any standards out there? I'm not too sure even. But I think definitely exposing people to good practices to avoid would be a great thing. And I think the other thing is important to say is that in our field, so this type of STEM field, people are even less inclined to communicate, and the art of effective communication becomes even more important in online education, where as you say, you can't rely on those non-verbal cues. You have to orally communicate it. So, that places skills requirements from that angle as well. So, that would be my main thoughts around what tutors need in distance education in the future.
Thanks so much, Catherine. You're very insightful. And Kepi, anything you wanted to add?
Yeah, I totally agree with Catherine on that, but more training definitely needed, especially with the rise in generative AI and its use. I think most institutions are getting less tense about the whole thing and just trying to see a bit more constructive way of using them in their teaching delivery. So I think having that broader scope in training where generative AI can be used, whether it's in actual content development or even marking, there's a lot of that going on as well at the minute, and feedback. So I think just general training is needed just to get people comfortable with the fact that this is a tool to support their teaching delivery and support students as well. And obviously it will make life a lot easier and get them to understand what they'll be doing when they go out into the big wide world, into industry, and how those tools are used there as well. So yeah, that's my thought.
That's good. Thanks so much, and Kepi. I think for me, I mean, I think we're already seeing some use of AI in distance learning. Like, for example, I'm noticing now that they're using some of these much better kind of artificial voices to provide the voiceover from some slides, rather than getting the actual tutors themselves to kind of provide the voiceover, which is interesting. And I think the other thing, just to kind of be maybe a little bit more kind of controversial, is that I think that some institutions think that at some point in the future, they'll be able to replace live lecturers with kind of AIs who would just basically make up their own kind of curriculum and delivery. I personally don't ever believe that'll happen because I just don't think an AI would be able to. Well, I mean, no, I'll take that back. It may well happen, right? But I think it will be to the detriment of educational quality and delivery overall, because I think the problem is that, as we probably see already, when you communicate with a with an AI, be that ChatGPT or whatever, a lot of the times they still use this very, what I call Eliza-like kind of response, which is the fact that, you know, if you ask them a question, they'll turn it around and go, "And what kind of X would you like?" Right? So effectively, they're not really trying to understand the question or interpret. What they're really trying to do is basically feed you something that's come from their kind of learning base, which is, in my opinion, maybe right, maybe wrong. In my opinion, that's not really what a tutor's there for. What a tutor's there for is to interpret what the student's trying to ask and then maybe present that information in another way. And I just don't think AI maybe never will be.
Just to potentially follow up on that, really, is one of the things that I thought was quite interesting, particularly on that last bit, is the future of teachers in terms of being potentially replaced. Like you say, I don't think that'll happen because I do think it is a fundamental skill. I think the risk, as with education, as in other sectors, is the entry-level jobs are the ones at risk. So those who are
Yes.
trainees, the associate lecturers, and so on. I do think as well, using an example of a certain language teaching company, people don't want to pay for something the way they feel like they're being taught by what they view as more of a budget-saving tool. And I think the human experience is valuable to people. I do think there was an article that said about my professors are telling me not to use AI, but I know they use AI in their feedback. I think that is a having an idea of what that normal is going to look like with teachers and students, and that disclosure. Look, I'm going to use it to support, say, my lesson planning, but that doesn't mean it's not going to. In my view, it might help with lesson planning. You provide all the content, what you want to deliver, the slides that you want to produce, but they provide the bureaucratic paperwork that you need to show as evidence because realistically, that adds no value to the student or to you. In some cases, it adds value to the management team who need it for compliance. And equally, I think I think particularly within distance learning, perhaps first is the out of hours tutor. I had a bit of a play around with AI myself to generate something similar, which basically was an AI where the students would engage could engage with that, ask the AI a number of questions, and the AI would generate the report that I could see that then allowed me to support the students when I next had a session with them. And I think there's possibly more scope for helping them out of hours, which would therefore take some pressure off teachers, lecturers, and so on. And I think that's more what I would hope to see, but I certainly think some places are going to try to their detriment to replace teachers with AI, and they'll definitely, I think, try to replace the more assistant teachers and so on, which I think that's because it's always seen as a quantitative value of those individuals rather than the qualitative value that they truly bring to those individuals.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think I agree. So, anyway, thank you both for attending today, and very much, especially to you, Jordan, for giving up your time and contributing to this meeting. Thank you very much, and please listen out for our next one. So, thanks, everybody.